Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Startup Diaries brought to you by Bernd Schirm. In this episode, we've got George Richardson, CEO of AeroCloud. He talks us through his background in motorsports and how he thinks that this has impacted the way in which he runs his businesses going forward. He then dives through the challenges he had in deciding how to fund the business and talks us through the journey of fundraising. We then go through how his market, which they're trying to disrupt, AeroCloud, is probably an overlooked one, and some very interesting input on that. And then finally, we dive into his viewpoint on hiring people remotely and whether you pay the employees based on geographical location or the going rate for their skill sets. We have some interesting discussion there. We hope you enjoy it. Welcome, George.
Yeah, welcome to AeroCloud World HQ in Macclesfield, Cheshire. Yeah.
Well, know it
nice
well.
Nice to have you.
Yeah. Poynton boy myself, so just down the road, grew up. Do you want to start off by giving us a bit of background on yourself and the story behind AeroCloud?
Yeah, my name's George. I'm currently 140th of the team here at AeroCloud, or one of 42, maybe I should say. Maybe that was the long way of saying it. But I'm a co-founder and CEO. I founded the business back in 2017 with my co-founder, Ian Ford-Smith. Ian has had a long history in airports. He's never actually had another job outside of the airport industry. And I, at the time, unbeknownst to me, was being connected to Ian through a mutual friend, and we met in a coffee shop. At the time, I was retiring from my previous career, and I was looking for an old lock, new key style tech company, because I'd been surrounded by a lot of successful technology entrepreneurs doing similar things. And me and Ian just hit it off, and we started talking about how we could change the world and really look into some huge ideas and out of all sorts of technology. And after a couple of years of sort of trying, we ended up with effectively doing what Ian used to do, because he sold a business back in 2011 doing what we do now, but in the cloud. So completely replacing legacy infrastructure of airport technology. So AeroCloud was born. AeroCloud is a crystal ball by the medium of software using AI and machine learning that helps airport operations execs predict the future. Mm-hmm. And it does that via our intelligent airport management platform, where we orchestrate all airport data and then spit it out the other side to allow airport execs to make data-driven decisions.
I think one thing I really want to dive into is the fact that you've obviously alluded to it there about you, I guess, are you a bit of a unique business background, well, career background, not necessarily business. How do you want to give a bit of background to sort of what got you up prior to AeroCloud, and how you think this has maybe helped you in your leadership and style of running AeroCloud as
Absolutely,
well?
Absolutely, yeah. So I retired as a professional racing driver in 2016. I effectively, that was my sole source of income from the age of about 16, mm-hmm. and I then retired at 26. Mm-hmm. And what I learned through being a professional driver in endurance racing, traveling a lot, liaising with lots of sponsors, high net worths that were born again racing drivers that wanted to employ my services to either race with them or teach them how to go faster, and also with car manufacturers, was how to orchestrate and provision and solve complex problems that revolved around funding of race teams or things like that. And what I quickly learned that I was okay as a driver. I was okay. But what I was really good at was putting deals together and connecting people of various backgrounds with teams or sponsors. And at one point, you know, I was managing, you know, world and global sponsors, not just in my sport, but in other sports as a consultant. Then obviously feeding some of that money into what I was doing, whilst balancing, you know, a couple of gentleman drivers that we were doing in sort of non-professional series, and also on a day rate to train up and coming drivers as well. And in my peak, I was doing about 36 weekends work a year. But at the end of the year, I'd sort of met all these amazing people and traveled, but I didn't really know my backside from my elbow. And I'd come home at Christmas completely burnt, and I needed something that was going to make money and grow without me, and I needed to work as part of a team. And motorsport is a team sport, but at the same time, like, everyone's tuned into what's good for them, FM, and it's super tough. Mm-hmm. And I knew I wanted to build something, so I started to consult the people around me, One of the people that I consulted was a guy called Gareth that connected me to Ian. And they were shaping industry, and they were doing big things in technology, investing in technology companies. They were venture capitalists. They were investors themselves. They were CEOs, CROs. And I just was a sponge for a couple of years. And that's how I decided that I wanted to build a large technology company. Way before that, racing is one of those fortunate sports that is not available to everybody, and it's not necessarily meritist. My family had built, you know, various successful companies, and I've always been around entrepreneurship my whole life. Our family life and my father's business effectively was just one in the same. And I knew I just couldn't work for anybody. I needed to work for myself, and I wanted to build an amazing team to shape and change something. And that accumulated into, you know, we're now sitting at nearly three rounds of funding. Aerocloud's 42 people. 2 years ago from now, it was three people, me and Ian and one developer called Alex, and then Rory, who's still with us now. And it's just been a wild 2 years. And I sort of feel now, coming into the Christmas time as well, as the time of recording this, that I'm equally as bamboozled, but I've really got something to show for it that isn't just, you know, money at the end of the day. And, you know, racing is transactional. It's you're not building anything other than a career that is ultimately then demising over time as you get older, less fit, et cetera, et cetera. So now I'm quite happy being overweight and CEO and sitting at my desk all day. It's quite fun.
I'd hardly call you overweight, to be fair. But so I'd just love to understand, you've obviously run a non-tech business there. Now you're in, obviously, a tech-led business.
Yeah.
What are the kind of fundamental differences, other than the fact that you probably, well, you maybe are working as many weekends, but you might be...
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. There's loads of similarities between racing. I did build a couple of businesses on the side of my racing that revolved around my racing and the travel and the people that I was meeting. And, you know, successfully exited one of those, and one of them still a shareholder in now, but I don't run on a daily basis. The difference with technology and the difference with venture-backed companies is that you have the ability to fail fast a lot quicker than you do as an organic business or a business that's not selling necessarily a scalable product. You know, our product can be sold to an airport of 100,000 passengers a year, and we also sell the same product to someone who's processing 50 million passengers a year. And the world is our oyster. We've got an international market. We speak seven different languages in the sales team. It's hyperscale, and it's fail fast. You combine that with venture capital money and, you know, seasoned organizational operational people. And the idea is that you don't just chuck money at stuff, but you chuck money and intelligence and been there before, done that before, at stuff, and you fail fast, and you find a formula that works, and then you heavily invest in that formula that works, and that is what I believe a lot of people to refer to as scale.
Yeah.
And that's what we're in the process of now. So just to give you an idea, we were less than half the size that we are at the start of this year.
Wow.
So in 11 months, we've doubled and a bit in headcount, in revenue, in customer base. The ARR per customer is ever increasing. We're upselling more than we've ever sold before. And that model has then accumulated to us making the next step in our journey, which is from seed company to a Series A company, a proper valuation.
I want to dive into that sort of Series A piece, but firstly, I'd love to understand actually quite quickly what the journey's been like for you this year. Like, obviously, if you've kind of doubled everything, what, is there any kind of key learnings that you've picked up in that, you know, that scale piece? Because adding more bodies, adding more clients, I'm sure there's, sound great, but I'm sure there's lots of headaches in there as well that you've had to solve as you go.
Yeah, so I can say that I've learned a lot, of course, but what's really worked for us, which I've not really heard many other people do, and I didn't know whether it was right or wrong at the time, but we split our business up into four. A lot of people do this, but I'll explain how we've done it, is that we knew that we wanted to fundraise at the end of the year. We didn't have to, but we wanted to secure a fundraise that started in September and finished in December, going into 2023, that we had a serious amount of capital in order to expedite this pace of scale. So working back from this December and planning in January, we split the year up into four quarters. The first quarter was a strategy where we needed to hire on the basis of what we already knew. That fell then into Q2. And then Q3 and Q4 we called pivot and pause. So the idea was, in the first however many months of the year previous or of years previous, we found the verticals in our business that needed the most amount of attention, and then had them look at how much output that they could give for ARR, which then drove Series A valuation, because that is one of the major metrics that incoming investors look, is how quickly can this company turn on ARR and what is the ultimate ARR. And that's, unfortunately, it's probably not the best metric, but it is a metric that Series A investors look for. So Pivot and Pause was highly successful because what it meant that we've done, and we're just finishing it now, obviously, the end of December, the last two quarters, we've stress tested every single element of our business, from implementation to recruitment to sales to finance to billing the customer to customer support, the whole breadth. And what we're now ended up with is, yes, a lot of people we've pushed hard, but they work for a startup, right? You know, they need to sign up into that culture. But at the same time, what we've now found is where those elements that we need to invest in now that we have the money post Series A. Mm-hmm. So going into Q1 of next year is pre-ramp up, and then from Q2 to Q3 is ramp up, and then from Q3 and Q4 is then hypergrowth.
Yeah.
So what I've learned is that segmenting it into bite-sized chunks and sticking to the plan is probably the best lesson I've learned. Mm-hmm. And then another thing I've learned is that the people that start the business are not necessarily always the people that are going to be there when it's a 150-person company.
Yeah.
That's a really difficult conversation to have for us. And that's starting to happen now about, right, what can we do to help you do your job better? Because clearly we've grown so much. Mm-hmm. I've grown so much. Our COO, my co-founder Ian's grown so much. But what do we need in and around you, whether that's below you job role-wise or whether that's above you job role-wise? How can we put those structures in place? Because we effectively all work for AeroCloud.
Yeah.
You know, we don't work for ourselves. And even though we want to expedite our own careers, we do know that we work for AeroCloud, and that's the main goal.
Yeah.
So they're the two major learnings, I'd say. And yeah, lots of others that I think you'd expect, but those are the sort of the main two, bite-sized chunks and stress testing, and then heavily investing in what works. And that's what we'll be doing from sort of Q2, Q3 onwards.
Well, obviously, you've alluded to there the next, you know, Series A round that you're going. Yeah. At the moment, as we speak, you're going through the rounds on that, and you're hopefully finalising it shortly by the time this is released. So hopefully be out in the press, etc.
Hopefully.
Do you want to tell us about the sort of decision-making around the different rounds of funding that you've made, and I guess a bit of the learning curve that you've gone through there as well to get to hopefully finalising this deal?
Yeah, we're incredibly lucky in a way, because me and Ian negotiated our first two big customers to pay upfront for the product that they were buying, which is quite unique. So Tampa International was a big customer of ours at the time, and they needed to develop different modules on top of what we were already selling them. And we basically said to them, we don't have the funds to do this. We're going to need a lot more developers, or it's going to take us ages. Mm. So I managed to negotiate that they would pay upfront for a 4 or 5 year term to start with, which is about $375,000. And we use that then to develop what is now our core product and product that we now sell to obviously other airports. And they gave us our leg up. But when we developed the product and when we were selling it to other airports, we knew that we couldn't survive off just that amount of funds because the market opportunity was so vast. Mm-hmm. So we decided that venture capital was right for us, opposed to taking, you know, debt or other forms of financing, because venture capital is a very expensive way of financing your business because you have to give away a lot of your equity. Mm-hmm. And we ran a competitive round back in 2020. We raised 1.2, I think, million pounds. And then about a year after that, we raised another 1.5 from exactly the same investors because we just knew we needed to double down. And that's what gave us then the round size of this. And the round size of this is £10 million.
Mm. Perfect. Awesome. I think one thing that I'd like to dive into is something that you referenced right at the beginning of when you introduced your sort of journey. And you used the phrase old lock, new key. And it was something that you were looking to identify in, I guess, the market that you wanted to build a business around. Can you explain what you mean by that, and then why you wanted to be a business sort of embedded in that type of market, really?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a high commitment, and you've got to have high conviction, obviously, because I didn't know anything about airports before I started AeroCloud, right? Or before I met Ian, for that matter. And now I'm embedded in the learning every single day about how to make airport operations specifically, and now passenger processing specifically, better for the next, and what the next 25 years looks like for airport ops. So it's a huge commitment. But I've just had this fascination always of not necessarily going with the tide and or with the trend, effectively, of what, you know, startups were doing. And when we were raising capital, you know, our investors are looking at 50 fintech proposals a week, but not one of them came across the desk as airport ops. And that just gives you an idea of the sort of the scale of the other opportunities out there. And I just wanted to do something, have an opportunity to change. When you look at our market, our legacy incumbents are that legacy, are that docile, are that sleepy, and in my opinion, they don't do a great job. And we do a really good job. And now the customer is caught up to thinking, oh, actually, they've got the referenceability now. AeroCloud have proven themselves over the last 2 years, fastest growing company they've ever seen in the space. I mean, we've gone from zero customers to now over 50 customers in the space of literally 2.5 years. And that referenceability is there. And we knew that we were onto something almost before the customer did, in a way. And that validation now looks all easy. Oh, that there was a glaring hole in that market. But when we started, there probably wasn't. We've made a hole and punched a hole of our own. And that's what you've got to be prepared to do if you're that way inclined. However, old lock and new key is really difficult because, you know, we have legislationary challenges. We sell to federal government. We have lots of regulatory hoops that we have to jump through and comply with. And they're significant, and they're a significant drain on time and resource. So, you know, it's horses for courses, for sure. But for me, it was attractive, and eyes on the prize now. It seems, touch wood, seems to be the right call. But it wasn't when we started, and it could have easily gone wrong.
Fair enough. Appreciate your honesty. I mean, one of the things to dive through is obviously being a recruiter myself, we see lots of differences in how people remunerate their staff. And one of the things we talked about was, obviously, we're a Northwest-based business here in Macclesfield, and you chose around, when you were hiring people remotely, you were discussing, do you want your employees to be, their salary to be based on their geographical location or on their skill set? Can you talk us through, you know, the decision that you made and why you took that one as well?
Sure. Well, I think, to date, we haven't made a decision on those sorts of things. But then moving forward into Q1 next year, we've made the decision. So I'll tell you really where we're at. The first point when you start a company is that you don't have access to all of the great people, because you are still a high risk to a lot of people. And trying to convince people out of jobs that they're really happy at is obviously very, very difficult. So we adopted a, let's pay proper money, let's find proper people, and let's give them lots of responsibility from day one, because we need to do that, right? We're growing so fast. One of the best hires we ever made is our head of people. And he came as a guy called Di Garrett, and he came from Market Finance and helped them scale between B and C, I believe. And they're a fantastic company, and he brought from them a fantastic culture and a way of hiring. And he was employee number 10, and then hired the other, you know, another 22 people as we stand now. And we would, and still currently, look everywhere for the best people to fit the JDs that we promote. However, moving forward, after lots of deliberation, back and forth, me speaking to lots of other founders that have been in this position, is that we believe there is a future in the office. We believe there is a future in office culture and locationary culture. And we will be committing to a geo-based hiring, which means that we will pay effectively market rate for the geographical location area. Now, there will be some exceptions to that. You know, data science is a role that is difficult to hire for. C-suite roles, VP roles are very difficult to hire for obvious reasons. But our core team will be here in the UK, in the north of England, hopefully likely to commit to this building here, actually, and be in Macclesfield, which has fantastic transport links from Manchester. People seem to love using Macclesfield. We've got everything from a Greggs right the way through to a fillet steak sandwich. We've got the lot here, and people seem to be very happy in this building and this location. In the US, we'll commit to a state, most likely be Florida, and we will try to build our culture around those locations. And as we move into Asia, we'll do Singapore or something like this. But what we've learned is that after the pandemic, the dynamic of people wanting to come into the office was changed for different teams. Different teams need different things from the office. Mm-hmm. But what we found is that people that live in Manchester, they're going against the tide of people coming out of Manchester in the morning. They love coming into the office. They're a real team, but they don't want to come in every day. Yep. So we developed what we call a red and blue team. Red is sales, I believe, and blue is tech. And we work on average, every employee will work on an average about 11 days from home per month. Mm-hmm. And then the second week of the month is what we call collab week. And then we all work on top of each other. We get everybody in the office. We mm-hmm. do pizza nights. We do what we call an AXE event, the AeroCloud Experience event. So we'll go bowling. We'll go on a walk. We've been go-karting, paintballing, all these sorts of things that you would expect from a tech company, effectively. Mm-hmm. And we try and build the culture in that week. Yeah. And then the fallout is, right, let's get some serious work done in and around the collab week. Yeah. So where we will be moving forward is we'll be a geo-based hiring strategy, very similar to a portfolio company that I learnt it from called Thought Machine, which is a fintech mm-hmm. at Playfair's portfolio as well. And they're heavily invested in New York, London, and Singapore. And we'll be heavily invested in Macclesfield, not as glamorous, most probably Sarasota, Florida, and then maybe Singapore. So.
Cool. I hope you won that go-karting, because I think...
Yes, I did, but and the trophy's just behind you there, actually, which I make all of the sales team look at every single morning when they come in and obviously clearly remind them of my years and years of grind trying to make it round and waste as much petrol as possible. But they did not make it easy for me. They deliberately put me at the back, and Mohammed in the computer vision team, he piled me into the first turn's wall and nearly put my back out again. And bearing in mind, I'm like two back ops in. It was not the nicest thing, so I've never let him forget that either. But yeah, it was good fun.
So someone took a kamikaze route to make sure you didn't.
Oh, he really did it. At the time, he hadn't been here that long either. It took me by surprise and everybody around us at that time. And, but yeah, he was great. It was a good night.
Brilliant. One of the things when we were putting this podcast together that I think you were really candid about is you believe there is a kind of lack of diversity at maybe the more senior roles within the business, but you've taken quite different routes to hopefully enable more diversity coming to the team by sort of retraction of key data to make it sort of blind CV reviews and stuff like yes. that. Probably one of the first businesses to do that has been on the podcast, to be honest. So that we know of. I don't think there's necessarily anyone else I can think of who's spoken about it as well. So yeah. I'd love to understand if you've been able to implement that and you've seen the effects of it yet, and sort of the decision making behind that as well to hopefully, I guess, open up that sort of hiring.
Yeah, sure. So it started with a live question. I think I was at a conference and I don't know whether it was deliberate or not, but I'm quite sensitive and I do think a lot about what people think of AeroCloud and how people perceive AeroCloud. And we're at a conference and I was in a similar sort of an event style forum. And obviously it's incredibly topical, and obviously we have, you know, we want to just hire the best people for the role, regardless of whatever. And they asked me, you know, why are there no X in your team? Why are there no Y in your team? And I said, well, it's not the case. And I had to answer it live. And I don't think I did a very good job of the answer, but sort of answered live. I was like, well, I don't really consider that. I look completely past all of that sort of stuff. I hire the best people for the role. But it did bother me. And I remember flying home and meeting with Diane saying, you know, this should bother me now. And I think we should probably have a look at it. But then not at the expense of not hiring the best person for the role. Because at the end of the day, we've got a duty to our board to deliver mm-hmm. financial results. And we're not here to partake. We're here to win. Mm-hmm. We're here not to tick every box. We're here to disrupt. And he said, okay, fine, let me come back to you. And he developed this blind hiring process, which, to my knowledge, and maybe we can articulate some of this and maybe we could write something on it and when I get a bit more information for him. But in effect, when we receive a CV, we don't know effectively, it sounds daft, but who it is. Mm-hmm. We don't know where they went to university. We just know they got a degree. We know that they worked at the companies that they worked at. We know that they're qualified for the role, but we don't know their name. We don't know their sex. We don't know their background or anything like that. And it's not because we had a problem. It's just that we wanted to remove anybody ever accusing us of using that sway. Mm-hmm. And for us, what it's done is it's a benefit, I think, when you're applying for a job at AeroCloud. it gives us the best possible chance of hiring the best possible talent. Mm-hmm. And it's been, touch wood, very effective. And yeah, I'm open to talk about it within the confines of what I can. Mm-hmm. And I'm grateful that we did it. And mm-hmm. anything more that we can do is great. But yeah. ultimately, I think, you know, companies may not say it in as black and white way, is that, you know, we really need to hire the best people mm-hmm. for the position, regardless of any factor that we could ever be accused yeah. of or whatever. So yeah. I think it's a sensitive topic,
yeah,
but one that bothered me and one that we had to do something about, and yeah. Touch wood, it's working.
Awesome. No, I think that's great. I mean, like, again, there's talk of a lot of businesses that we know of doing it, but no one's actually necessarily implemented it yet. So okay. I'll definitely want to come back to you and maybe next year when you're going through that hyper-growth period and saying, how is that, you know, looking now? And
sure, is it scalable or
yeah.
whatever? Yeah, but
that'd
be interesting. Yeah, but the thing is that if you've got the right person looking at the CV, which yeah. we have, mm-hmm. And, you know, when we're meeting people, and we do meet an awful lot of people, we interview an awful lot of people for the roles, I hope that people feel supported through the process. And if that's an advantage to us in the hiring process, I'm all for advantages. It's yeah. a competitive market, right? And, you know, arguably has been the most competitive ever this year.
Yeah.
Whether we see that next year or not, mm-hmm. I think there's going to be a bit of a change. I think things got a bit crazy this year.
As a recruiter, I really hope so. It'd be yeah. nicer to have a bit of balance in the sort of sway.
Well,
of
yeah, as a recruiter, you probably don't want it to change too much.
But look, we come to the last two questions now that we always ask all our guests. The first one is kind of diving into what you would think is the biggest challenge in your career to date, mm-hmm. and sort of talking through your learnings on it as well.
I think my biggest challenge to date is maintaining an element of who I am and want to be. And I want to be the dumbest person in the room all the time. I want to ask all of the questions, help me understand this, tell me how to do this, et cetera, et cetera. And then I like to listen to lots and lots of opinions. And then I like to think that I back myself to make the right decision after listening to all of those ideas. So if you spoke to people around me, that you'll find lots of people that are, you know, being called at 11 o'clock at night, at 6 a.m. in the morning, whenever I've got an idea, I sort of have none of those personal boundaries with right. my mentors. And I'm that type of guy that's always on the phone. What do you think of this? What do you think of that? Whatever. But I always come back to them and say, oh, I did this in the end. And I don't necessarily agree with all of the opinions I get, but what I want to stay consistent. And I probably had a period in the middle of the year when, you know, we're entering into that growth, or there was a question mark against that growth. Could George do what he's going to say he's going to do, et cetera, et cetera. Might have lost a bit of confidence in myself for that decision-making ability. But I know now that, you know, I'm not by any stretch the perfect CEO or the perfect operator, but I really back myself to ask mm-hmm. The question, listen to the answer, and then come to what's right at the time. And you don't get all the decisions right. You probably get 7 out of 10 right. Mm-hmm. And if you're doing that, you're probably doing a good job.
Yeah.
So I'd say that's probably my biggest learning this year, but it changes. I mean, you know, we're in the business of learning, and in a fast-moving business like this, your duty of care is to continue to learn. You can't be stuck in your ways, and I want that from my team as well. I want everybody with an open mind. Yes, we do have titles. Yes, there is a COO. Yes, there's a CTO and a CEO, but, you know, I want to be learning from people, you know, doing stuff that I'm completely oblivious or unaware of, because that's what makes AeroCloud a special business, not yeah. just a special business to work for, but it just has a great feel, AeroCloud, and, mm. and that learning is the core of it. And I hope that continues for yeah. however big it gets.
Awesome. Final question is always kind of an advice piece for either listeners who, you can take it either way you'd like, so it's two angles to it. So either anyone thinking about starting their own business and starting their own from the scratch, or someone who's looking to join a startup, you can take it either way you'd like. There's an advice around that.
Sure. Well, let's look at starting your own business first. And I've done many of those. If you look at Companies House, I think I'm now up to maybe 16 or 17, and they're all not been as successful as this one potentially is going to be. So you've got to mitigate and have a very mature conversation with yourself about your personal risk. And starting a business isn't always, it's not necessarily meritist. The best, you could be the best mind or have the best idea, et cetera, but your situation might prevent you from starting a company. For me, I'm very lucky. The worst that, I mean, I only moved out of my mum's house at 29, and I'm 31 now, right? Or even 30, maybe closer to 30. But I was all in, and I was able to be all in. You know, I knew that if it all went wrong, effectively, I'd just start again. Not everybody has that luxury. A lot of people don't have that luxury. So you've got to have a really honest conversation with yourself about the risk and the upside. Anyone can dream about the upside. Anyone can talk about the upside. But how are you going to get through those early years? How are you going to finance those early years, not just to feed yourself, but feed the people that you employ? How are you going to look someone in the eye and say, you know, I am going to be responsible for paying your mortgage for the duration of how long you work for me? That's really difficult. And a lot of people talk about, oh, what's the quality of, you know, people starting businesses? But it's perseverance, grit, determination, and mitigating and managing your risk on a daily basis. And it really is not for everybody. I think it's glorified now about starting your own business to a certain degree. It's really not for everybody. I can assure you that it's very, very tough. And it's very, very tough when it's going well, because everyone has a boss in venture-backed businesses. And if you own 100% of the equity and it's still going well, hat off to you. But everybody that I talk to, we're still answering to somebody because we've decided to take the money, or we've decided to commit to that customer, or whatever it may be. So you have to be very comfortable with your risk and mitigate it in a very sensible way. But look at what you're doing and look back at what you're doing as every success, because life is not, in my opinion, life is not linear. Mm-hmm. It doesn't grow incrementally. You grow 1, 2, 3 steps forward, and you might go 5 steps back, or you might go 10 steps back, and then you might go 10-20 steps forward, or whatever. And I think that that's what people need to realize is when you see an entrepreneur that's exited, or you see an entrepreneur with 15 major companies like Elon Musk, and it's like, oh, you know, they're looking at him at his end of his journey, but they don't look at the start. And he'll tell you, I'm sure, as many people will tell you, is that life is a ever-changing, you know, game of snakes and ladders.
Yeah.
In terms of working for a startup, that again is the same sort of thing. Like, working at a startup is always a perceived risk. However, I'd start to look at the founders. I'd ask to meet the founders if I was working at a startup in any position. And I think that you should have the confidence to do that. And I think you should start to look at the whites of the founders' eyes when you say, you know, what's the, I know that you can't plan 5 years in advance, but what's the strategy for the rest of this year? Where do you want to be in the rest of this year? Who are you going to take money from? What's your target customer? Can you talk to me why you started the business? And look at the founder and start to understand to them if they've got a burning passion for doing what they're doing. If they wake up every day wanting to change airport management software or wanting to create the next fintech, you've got to be looking at how committed they are to the cause. And then your first early months, you know, just note, is the founder, you know, putting the yards in? Is he or she constructive in their feedback? Are they always wanting to learn? Do they ask your opinion or not? And that should be then your second bit at the end of your probationary, where you can, you know, you walk or not. I would highly recommend that people at the start of their careers look at startups way before they start looking at a big corporate company. I think big corporate company is where, in my opinion, where ambition or a lot of ambition goes to die. And I think that it's so much more dynamic. You will learn so much more from good people that you're working with. Try and get yourself under somebody who's fantastic at what they do, and just be a sponge for the first couple of years. And then, you know, for, say, older people or people at the sort of, you know, the coming out of the corporate background, you've got an awful lot of experience. But when you come to a startup, be prepared that people are A, going to question it, mm-hmm. and B, going to want to use it. But they're going to want to use it at a pace that you're not used to.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to be prepared for pace of change. You've got to be prepared for people changing strategy within the day, within the hour, within the half an hour meeting. And welcome it. Don't resist it.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that's what I would say of what I've learned over the past. And I think the startup game is for people with the right attitude opposed to the right level of experience. I would always pick attitude over experience every single day of the week.
Love it. I love it. We'll call it there, but thanks, George. Really appreciate it. Hopefully you enjoyed it. That's that.
Yeah, great.